This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack. But with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Watley on KLZ 560.
Good afternoon and welcome to Haystack Help Radio. Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, today means it's the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesch, our good friend. And we're going to talk about a lot of great topics today with Kevin. And first of all, Kevin, welcome.
Thank you very much. How are you, Scott?
Good, good. And I wanted to kick it off today. There's been a few things in the news lately with Uber drivers and some accidents and some people getting killed. And so, man, it made me think about, you know, what do we always talk about just our personal kind of accidents, and we're kind of in control of our own insurance, all the different things that we have or don't have. But if you get in a car, let's say me, you and I,
right,
we get an Uber ride to your office from here.
Yep.
That guy gets into an accident, or somebody hits them. So we can approach this several different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the interesting thing with both Uber and Lyft is that both of the companies, the drivers are supposed to have their own insurance. And for a period of time now, it's been sort of a gray area for both of those companies as to whether or not there's also another policy behind the actual, because remember, they're driving their own vehicles.
Right.
And so the companies, and I've got a couple of these cases right now pending, and it's really interesting as to how the sort of what we've decided as to how to analyze these cases with regard to insurance coverage. So by contract, the drivers of both of these companies are supposed to have insurance themselves. The drivers are supposed to have insurance relating to their vehicle, so that if you and I are passengers in the vehicle, then that insurance will cover. Some of those insurance policies, though, over time, if the Uber driver or the Lyft driver haven't told them that they're actually driving for a commercial purpose.
Well, let's face it, the premiums are going to be much higher.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's how, when these companies started off, how they were able to sort of have a lower premium or a lower cost per ride, because some of that was offloaded to the drivers. But now the insurance companies are being smarter about having their policies say, or you have to disclose whether or not you're doing this sort of ride sharing. And then I think their premiums are different. At any rate, so some drivers could have been, these situations, you could be excluded from coverage.
Right.
And so what people are finding is that you get into these accidents and the driver of the Uber, he or she has insurance, but that insurance may not apply. And then you have to go to the company itself. Well, then there's a legal issue there with regard to independent contractor and whether or not this vehicle is covered by the commercial policy for either Uber or Lyft. And so that has been litigated to some degree. And our experience has been that there is another policy a lot of times that will cover, and so that you've got that secondary coverage. Then, you know, in the event that you get into an accident where it's an at-fault party, so the at-fault party's insurance will cover as well as you as a passenger, because the at-fault party caused the accident. So you should have coverage there. And then finally, what we always talk about is, in the event that you're in a car accident, like this rideshare situation with these companies, and there's not enough coverage anywhere else, you still have your underinsured motorist coverage.
Gotcha.
That will cover you as well. But it's really it's much more complicated than you'd expect it to be. And quite frankly, it's different if you have a regular taxi ride, because those companies have different insurances than these rideshare companies do.
Right. So, I mean, if we get one of these guys or gals that pull up, should we ask to see?
Yeah, you almost want to see if they have insurance. No, that's a really good point. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and they should.
And if they say, "Oh, well, yeah, Lyft covers this,"
I would be concerned.
Yeah,
Because some of them are probably going without it and violating their contract. And also, you could be in an uninsured vehicle.
Yeah, but you got four people that jump in a car, and you get into a serious accident.
That's a really
good point.
That's
going to add up really quick.
Very quick, especially if you've got somebody that's got minimum limits, $25,000. That's just not going to be enough coverage.
Wow.
Yeah, and so it is a real issue.
Yeah.
And it's one that you really, I know it's not something you want to consider when you get into an Uber or Lyft, but you certainly should be concerned about it if you want to be, if you're risk averse.
From your understanding, is there much of a screening process to become a Lyft or Uber driver?
Not my impression, there's much, no.
That's scary, man. You just get picked up by somebody.
Yes. It is. It is completely something that's really unusual, especially, you know, for women and younger folks or older people.
Right. That, but man, everybody's, I mean.
I know, everybody's using
it's a huge business.
It is.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that it's a bad business.
Oh, I mean, either. Yeah.
But it, I mean, I've used it on several occasions, and every time I get into the vehicle, I have that same sort of thing run through my head as to what is the situation here? What am I getting myself into?
Right.
Not that other situations with taxi cabs and the other types of available transit that we have is probably any better. But certainly, yeah, there is less. Depends on what you are. If you're a person that really believes that the government will do a better job of screening than private companies, then you don't take Uber or Lyft because
right.
they're not really regulated at this point.
Wow.
Yeah.
Again, just something to think about because, again, boy, a lot of people use these. And when you see these accidents and, unfortunately, even some lives that were lost in some of these accidents, it can be very, very serious.
And certainly it goes back to the same thing that we were talking about all the time is make sure you have under insurance UIM coverage mm-hmm. because that covers you in that sort of situation. And when you're in somebody else's vehicle, it's just a really good coverage for you to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, a couple weeks ago when you were here, we had a Dr. Rademacher on with
yeah.
us, and we were talking about all the medical things. We're talking about choosing the good doctor and all that. So I thought we'd kind of start off today with just talking a little bit about, you know, boy, there's so many crucial steps once you've had an accident, and probably the most crucial is choosing you. I mean, you know,
right.
choosing the right attorney that's good for you.
Absolutely.
We'll start off. That's why you do free consultations, because you want to see, hey, first of all, do they have a case? All right. And if they do, are you a good fit with them and them for you?
Right. That's exactly right. So, anybody who's doing this sort of work, the personal injury work, the car accidents, the slip and falls, the other sorts of negligent injury sort of work that we do, everybody that does it is going to offer a free consultation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, if you get somebody that's saying, yes, come on in, but we'll charge you $300 for you, I mean, that's just not something in the industry
right.
that happens.
Right.
Because for those of us that are doing this on a regular basis, we all recognize that people, when they get hurt, the majority of the people don't have the 6 months of savings that they say we should have, and that they're in dire straits from the
mm-hmm.
beginning. Most people are paycheck to paycheck, and we get it. I mean, you can't get good representation in this line of work, or if you want to do these sorts of cases where you say, I'm going to do it on an hourly basis.
Right.
It just doesn't happen. People don't have the reserves, and they really are going to be using that to get through their lives while these injuries are healing and while they're taking care of everything rather than paying a lawyer. And that's perfectly understandable. And so we take some risk. The idea is the free consultation, we get together with the person, they get to meet us, we get to meet them.
Mm-hmm.
That's just as much as important as the client picking us as we picking the client. And it's just a time for us to talk and get to know each other. I really enjoy the free consultations to find out about a person and find out what they're going to be like in stressful situations and,
sure.
and find out if we're a good fit in the sense of not everybody finds my demeanor appealing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
some people want the sort of banging on the table, yelling and screaming, just out of control sort of lawyer. I know it seems unusual, but that there are people that think that that's
right.
effective
right.
for their particular case, and that's not how we operate, and that's not how we manage our business. And so we have a conversation, and we go through, and we steadfastly understand all the different elements of what the case is going to entail. And then we figure out whether the person wants us to do the work for them. And if they do, then we enter into a written contract, and away we go.
Right. And I think, too, you can make some calls, I guess, but if it comes down and you pick a couple that you're interested in, got to do that face-to-face meeting.
You do.
I think it's better for everybody.
You really do. I mean, people, for example, in this show, I get calls, and they'll be like, well, we heard you on the radio, and we want to retain you. And I say, great, but let's meet. Let's make sure that you feel comfortable and that I feel comfortable with you, because
right.
I think it's really important. This business, these service types of businesses, you can certainly do over the internet or
mm-hmm.
or by phone calls. But I think there's still some real value in the human interaction between the people that are going to be working together, because there's going to be times, no matter what case it is, there's always going to be a time where I'm going to have to trust the client, or the client is going to have to trust us in the evidence and the recommendations that we're making. And so to start off being in the same room together and remembering each other and knowing what you look like and,
sure.
and that sort of thing is really important, I think.
Right.
And that's one of the things that's maybe different than the way many other firms handle the cases. Mm-hmm. We think it's important for you to see the lawyer that's going to be handling your
right.
case. And so those are differentiations.
Right. And trust, I think you know, of course, anytime you have a legal issue, you hope you got to have that trust of the attorney. But I think in this, especially, because you're really going to be advising us on different things of, hey, as far as care, when the right time is, hey, I think I've done the most I can do for you. You need
right.
to trust me in that. And you've probably had some people, oh, I think we can get more. You know,
yeah.
Look, I'm telling you, this is what I do every day.
Right.
I know we're kind of at the limit here.
I have a case a week where we have that discussion, where we have to talk about valuation, because it's not an exact science. And as much as, you know, the advertising and the other things that you hear out in sort of the internet sphere mm-hmm. about what these cases are worth, there is a real adversarial process. The insurance companies and the folks on the other side that have the checkbook that are willing to write checks are always willing to write a dollar less than they think they're going to have to. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, the idea is that they're always scrutinizing what they're doing. They're skeptical of the damages and the requests of the plaintiffs, no matter what. And there just is not very often where we get done and we settle a case, and I'm surprised that we got as much as we did. It's always a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always the argument about what's an appropriate value. And that's part of the process. If it wasn't there, you know, I wouldn't be needed. I mean, if we could
right.
throw in numbers into a computer, I mean, there are definitely those sorts of programs out there, but they still don't give the human aspect of it and why one particular case is worth more than another. They just have to, it's part of, you know, there's part of an emotional dynamic. There's part of a, what's the plaintiff going to be like for a witness? And all of those aspects of their life coming together to get a sense of what the thing is worth.
Right. Once again, this is the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesh. If you've got any legal questions, we'll open up the phone lines, 303-477-5600, and we'd be glad to take your call. You know, when we talk about your tagline, one that we do is we say trial tested, trial ready.
Yeah.
There are firms out there that have no desire whatsoever to take something to trial.
Yes.
They want to try to work the insurance company as much as they can by phone, get the settlement as quick as they get their portion, they give the rest to the client, and
yep.
they're done.
Yeah.
And on to the next case.
That's right.
Your philosophy on taking things to trial.
Yeah, so the idea with taking things to trial is there are times where we will have a case. I had a case this week that we took to trial. I was in trial Monday and Tuesday this week, and it was a case that both the insurance company and I think myself had a question as to who was responsible. It was a multi-car case, and there were several people that were rear-ended in the collision. And the question was, is the person at the end of the line responsible, or the person that starts it that whips out into traffic responsible? And so that's the sort of trial that we went on. And those questions sometimes have to be answered so that you get a sense of what jurors are thinking in the community, because that is a dynamic that we just don't know. I mean, we can have arguments in a conference room or,
sure.
or on the radio about it, but until you get six or seven people in a room deciding after they've heard evidence, you don't know exactly how it's going to work. And so those sorts of things are important for us, in my opinion, are important for us to do, because the insurance companies, all of these sorts of questions and discussions are out there. Both the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar have their own chat rooms, and they have their own ability to talk about it, and you get a reputation about whether or not you'll try a case or not.
Right.
And that affects whether or not the insurance company thinks you'll cave at the end, just before trial, or whether or not when you say we're going to trial, they know they're going to trial. And that's important, because the insurance company knows most of the time, with us in particular, that they need to put all the money on the table, and then we'll be rational about whether or not it's an appropriate risk for us to take a trial and what the client wants to do.
Because you build a reputation not only in the court system with DAs
yeah.
and judges and all, but also with the insurance companies. They look at your file and they go, you know what, man, this guy's always fair with us. And, you
yep,
know,
gives us
but we also know he ain't going to mess around, and he will take us to trial.
No, that's right. And that's, I think that's really important for people to consider because, you know, in our situation, we're not a firm that hides medical records. We're not a firm that redacts things that don't need to be redacted. Defense lawyers know that when they're dealing with us, we're going to put everything out on the table. We're not going to sugarcoat stuff. If there's a bad part of our case, we're going to deal with it. We're going to make it as good as we can. But we're also not going to get into gamesmanship relating to it. And they'll know that if we say we're going to do something, we're going to do it. And so that helps everybody. And it definitely helps our clients because, I mean, the insurance company knows I went to trial a year and a half ago on a case that was worth $1,500 because they would only offer us $300. And I was like, you know, that's just not right. I know it's not a big case, and I know it's going to take us 2 days to try it, but let's try it and see if our estimation of what the case was worth was accurate. And it was. The jury gave us more than what we were asking for. So those sorts of things help us in that defense lawyer in that particular case knows the next time when they have a $500,000 case that they're staring at and we're saying we want a $500,000, that probably our valuation is close and they need to get up to that. And if they don't, then we're going to try the case.
Right.
And that's important, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Again, our lines are open. If you've got a legal question, Kevin will be glad to answer it for you. 303-477-5600. You can check out Kevin's website at fleshlawfirm.com. And we will be glad to take your call. Give us a call, 303-477-5600.
Without changing your budget, own your home faster. Take AIM, 720-895-0500. Many of our clients have learned to pay less interest to the bank, not change their spending habits, and own their home faster. Affordable Interest Mortgage has a possible solution. 720-895-0500. Does your current loan allow you to access your equity without refinancing for another loan at higher rates? Does your current loan allow your equity to make your mortgage payment without late fees or dinging your credit? At AIM, we have a loan that allows you those freedoms, all for 30 years. This could be the last loan you need. Pay off your home faster, pay less interest to the bank, access your equity when you need it, skip payments. Call AIM for details, 720-895-0500. If you're tired of paying all that interest up front on a traditional 30-year fixed, call 720-895-0500 and let us save you thousands. Home of the Asset Manager, locally owned and operated, where it is all about you. 720-895-0500. Regulated by DOR, NMLS 298191, Equal Credit Lender.
Littleton Heating and Air Conditioning is proud of their 45 years of HVAC service to Littleton, Highlands Ranch, and Denver metro area. Littleton Heating and Air Conditioning is your Lennox and Carrier expert heating and air conditioning contractor. They are proud to offer the finest heating, air conditioning, and indoor air quality products with prompt and professional customer service and satisfaction. Call today and mention Haystack Help Radio and save $25 off any repairs or $100 off your furnace installation. Call 303-798-3880. That's 303-798-3880 for your appointment today. Littleton Heating and Air, A-plus members of the Better Business Bureau and official Haystack Help registered company.
Ladies, I know you're tired of walking into the local gun store and seeing the same old thing. So let me tell you about Rampart Firearms. Just a quarter mile up Highway 67 off of Santa Fe and Sedalia, you will find a great selection of guns, ammo, tactical, and personal defense weapons. And if you or your spouse love to hunt, Rampart Firearms is a great stop for all of your hunting needs. Shotguns, rifles, pistols, anything from predator hunting to your next big game trip. Head to Rampart Firearms at the foot of the Rockies. Open 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. And you will only pay a 4% tax on your purchase. RampartFirearms.com, 720-468-0050. That's 720-468-0050.
Rush to Reason with John Rush. Weekdays from 3 to 7 on KLZ 560.
Welcome back to Haystack Help Radio. My name is Scott Watley along with Kevin Flesh. Kevin's number 303-806-8886. I always tell you, put that number in your phone. Hopefully you never need it, but when you do have the need, we want it to be right there at your fingertips. So Kevin, finishing up on the, you know, just talking with the attorney and choosing an attorney. Evaluation of the case. Everybody wants to know, well, what do you think it's worth?
Right.
I mean, do you sometimes you give a range, or but if a guy looks in and goes, oh, I can get you $100,000, I mean, that's probably That's the
completely
best thing to do.
No, it's completely speculation. And anybody who does this on a regular basis is going to say to you, especially early on in the case, you know, you call me 3 days after the car accident happened. I had this happen last week where the person's like, okay, I went to the ER. You know, I'm going to do some more treatment. And they're like, well, what's it worth? you don't know. I mean, I could give them a number, but it would be completely speculative. Mm-hmm. And you just don't know. You need to complete that treatment, because sometimes treatment goes well and you get better quickly. And then, I mean, the case value occurs in three. There are three components of it. The first part of the component of how to value a case is who's at fault. So if the accident is clearly somebody else's fault, that's great for valuation, because it's one of those situations where you can point your finger at one person. The example that I had this week, for example, we had three different people that could have been at fault for the accident. Well, that valuation of what the case is worth completely changes, because now you've got three different options, one of which is the plaintiff. And so if the plaintiff is at fault, even 20%, the valuation of your case has just been reduced by 20%, because the plaintiff doesn't get, they don't get paid for their own fault, right? So that's the first part. And so there's a real important part of proving liability that needs to be done first. And it's difficult to do that over the phone, because you need to see the police reports. You need to see what people are saying about what took place, that sort of thing. So unless it's a clear-cut liability mm-hmm. case, then that's going to affect the valuation. The next thing is making sure that the accident was actually the cause of the injuries. That's generally pretty easy to figure out, unless you have a long-term problem with the sense that you had the accident and you didn't treat right away, or there's a superseding accident, or you fell down a flight of stairs after having a car accident. I mean, there's lots of things that can happen. All right, so the cause isn't as big of a deal. But the last thing then is the treatment. And how long did you treat? How did it affect your life? Did you have lost wages? All of those sorts of things. I just can't give you a number in a first appearance. And, you know, you can't do it from a billboard. I mean, there used to be billboards that would say, what's your case worth, and that sort of thing. And so it's a little bit more complex than people want to recognize. And the short answer generally is not the right answer. And so we've got to develop the case, and that's really where our value comes in, is helping people get through that process and really getting a valuation then at the end. When you're done with your treatment, you're at maximum medical improvement, and everything is able to be documented. Because before then, I had a case last week where the person wants to make a wage claim. They're self-employed, and all of the documentation we have relating to their tax returns, their income actually goes up after the accident. So that's not going to help us any in saying that they lost income, because what they want us to say is I lost $10,000 a month during this period. But it's really speculation, because everything we have shows they made the same or more. And their argument is, well, I lost opportunity. Well, then you're going to have to provide us evidence of that lost opportunity. People that will write affidavits or write letters to say, I would have hired this person, but I didn't because of their injuries. And those are more difficult to find. And so when somebody comes and they say, I want to know what my case is worth in the initial consultation, I'm a little concerned about that, because I just don't know, and I want to be fair with them. I could make up a number, like you said, just to get them in the door. And there are people out there that will. Mm-hmm. And that's just not how we do business.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, you know, the comments that I make to clients in that initial interview about what I think valuation is, I put that in my intake so that I remember going back, oh, well, this is what I told them. Because many times people will get to the end and they will be disappointed in where they're at, because maybe they just didn't treat as much as they thought they were going to need to. Or maybe they thought, you know, this is sort of a lottery ticket for me, you know, and that's perfectly understandable based upon what we see in TV and other advertising. But that's just not in reality how it works.
Right. You do everything you can once you get involved with the case, you know, to build that case and keep everything flowing in a good way. But what can clients sometimes do in a negative way that can affect their case in a negative way?
Yeah, so the clients, I mean, I always want to try to be as positive with them as possible, but it's certainly I've got a case right now where the client came to us a week before the statute of limitations ran, and he sort of managed his case on his own up until that point. So what he did, he didn't treat on a regular basis.
It's 2 years? Three.
Three on a car accident.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he had an accident. in 2014, and he came to us in 2017, literally 3 days before the statute of limitations ran. And he has a good case. There's nothing wrong with the case other than I would have liked to have had. He's got a traumatic brain injury from it. And so an individual in that sort of situation doesn't manage their care as well because of their disability, because they just aren't able to manage their life as well. So if he would have come to us in 2014, we probably wouldn't been able to help him document what exactly is going on with him better than he has now for evidence.
Right.
Because head injuries in particular, or mental health issues that happen because of car accidents, are a lot of times not documented well with primary care physicians or other specialists that really aren't neurologists or somebody else that can really document what's going on with this person in the way of their cognitive difficulties. Mm-hmm. And normally folks with those cognitive difficulties aren't taking care and keeping track of all the things that are going on in their life so that they can remember them later, because that's just part of what their problem is, right? And so that is an example of where if he would have been more proactive earlier on in the case, we probably would have been able to increase the value of the case.
I start to say, I mean, 3 years, and you look at all that you could have done, he probably cost himself money.
He did. He definitely did. He probably cost him $100,000. I mean, he really did in inactivity. Because in the event that we would have been able to get him to someone, he's on the Western Slope, and if we would have been able to get him to a specialist in Grand Junction, or we would have been able to get him to somewhere here to do an evaluation and have a plan so that we then could show what exactly was going on and his progression as to things went, and what he needs in the future, it's very much a different story than where he's at.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a lack of gap in treatment, and it really, sometimes doctors are your best advocates because they see you on a regular basis and they can talk about you objectively as to how things are going.
Right. And this would not only include, just a regular auto accident, but also slip and falls, any of that kind of thing.
Yeah, especially with head injuries. No matter what the mechanism relating to a head injury, it's always, if somebody else is at fault for your injuries, you want to make sure that you've done everything right. Because think about it, the insurance company is always skeptical. Jurors are always skeptical. And so you really have to persuade them that, number one, you're a credible person, and number two, the people that are treating you are credible, so that they recognize, hey, they get past that skepticism and they really believe this person has a real issue.
Right.
I find in trials, like the last trial we had, the jurors now can ask questions of witnesses as long as the court approves the question. So the way it works is
in front of every, I mean.
Oh yeah.
Oh really?
They write out the questions, but the way it works is, so in a normal witness, you're up on the witness stand. I'm doing my direct exam, so I'm asking you first all the questions I want to ask you. Then the other side gets to ask you cross-examination, and so they get to ask you all the questions they want to ask you. And then I get to, in most situations, I get to go back and do what's called redirect. And so I get to clean up sort of the issues that the other side has brought up to make sure that everybody understands what's going on. And then even sometimes there's recross, and that sort of ends the conversation with the lawyers and the witness. Then the court gets to ask the jurors, okay, jurors, have you written out any questions that you would personally like to ask this witness? And the jurors can do that, and then those questions are taken up to the judge, and the lawyers and the judge look at the questions and determine whether or not those questions are allowed under the law, just like a lawyer would ask them.
Right.
And those questions a lot of times are really insightful for me to understand what the jurors are thinking. So in this last trial, we didn't really have any questions from the jurors except for one of the chiropractors that testified that